This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
At Emmanuel Temple, located at 1033 North Sumner Street, Dr. Alexander is the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. There will be a community fair, a community panel, and Michelle will read from her book. For more info, go to kboo.fm.
Into the world I plunge, through my headphones, escaping to the streetlight. I begin to believe in destiny when my...
Good morning and Happy New Year from all of us here at APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Kushlani D'Souza, and today we're taking a look back at some of our favorite stories from 2012 in this, our annual Best of APA Compass show. You'll hear interviews with comedian Hari Kondabalu and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jose Antonio Vargas, as well as a performance of Race Monologues by Golden Salazar and Musa Ahmed. We'll also feature one of our favorite Angry APA Minutes of the Year from APA Compass Collective member Sarika Mehta, and a new Angry APA Minute from me, because let's face it, there's always something, right? First up, Andrew Ye's interview with Kyung Ung, whose book, Golden Leaf, discusses his experiences as a survivor of the Khmer Rouge genocide.
Today on APA Compass.
Everything I do is guided by the memory of those who did not survive. And it's driven by the honor and the dignity of the survivor.
That voice is Kyung Ung, a survivor of the Khmer Rouge rule in Cambodia. He reads from his autobiographical poem, Living Dead.
Roman philosopher Marcus Tullius Cicero once said, "The life of the dead is placed in the memory of the living." The life of the dead is placed in the memory of the living. I, Golden Leaf, behold such memory. But for one decade, over two and about three, the memory manifested as pain, anger, and fear. Half a world the distance, yet the memory is profoundly near. Clear as glass, the memory of those who passed lived in my nightmare. Scarred but unbroken, onto paper I penned nightmare into dream. A book I published, the memory I preserved, and dignity I redeemed. No more to lose, but everything to gain. They who died have not died in vain. The nightmare I suffered, a golden purpose I gained.
You're listening to APA Compass, and my name is Andrew Ye. Today we welcome Keelung Ung as our special guest. Keelung is a survivor of the Khmer Rouge rule in Cambodia from 1975 to 79. The 1984 drama film, The Killing Fields, helped tell the story of this era. Keelung has written his memoir, Golden Leaf, a Khmer Rouge genocide survivor, to share his experiences. He survived and escaped to Thailand and eventually landed in Portland, Oregon for high school and college. He's now giving back to the community through the Royal Rosarians and other service organizations locally, and through the Golden Leaf Education Foundation in Cambodia. Keelung, it's a pleasure to have you join us today.
Thank you, Andrew.
So how old were you at the start of the Khmer Rouge regime? And could you give us a picture of your family life before that time?
I was a teenager. I was born sometime in the early 60s. When the Khmer Rouge took over in 1975, I had a normal life like everybody else. I completed seventh grade. And my mother was selling food to support the family. My sisters and I were in schools. And all of that went away in 1975.
Your family, unfortunately, was not spared. You lost 10 members of your family and over 50 relatives. Would you consider your experience to be unfortunate but typical? Or was your family especially targeted by the Khmer Rouge?
I say unfortunate, but also typical. Everybody you talk to would lose a handful to 10, 15 people in the family. So the feeling is that I think it's about 2 million people that were killed.
And could you share an experience from that period of your life? Maybe something that's really stuck with you over the years or something that was life-changing?
Starvation is probably the most excruciating and the most memorable thing, especially if you have to do it for a period of time between 1975 and 1979. Watching people die every day, have to go to work, and being a slave and have had no freedom. Those are some of the things that it's always stuck in my mind.
Now fast forward almost 30 years.
All right.
So what prompted you to write your memoir, Golden Leaf?
For decades, even though, you know, I began to have successes in life, the memory was still hurting me. I had a nightmare every night. My average sleep is 3 to 4 hours a night. And it was hurting. So you want to forget this memory. Okay, so on the one hand, I wanted to forget the memory that was hurting me. And then on the other hand, if I were to forget all this bad memories, this horror, all of the things that happened would have happened in vain. You know, I lost my parents, and if I lost this memory, and then that memory would be gone. And then the other thing is, you know, I wanted to leave behind, I want an evidence. So this is an evidence that things that happened, and I want my children to learn about it. It's much easier to write it down and have the children read the story as they get older and as they're ready, rather than just trying to tell them. So I published a book, and after I published a book, I don't remember when's the last time I had a nightmare since I published a book in 2009. Every night now I have a dream. I remember I get up, I have a dream, and it's wonderful things. I don't have to struggle with these conflicting memories. On the one hand, you want to forget about it, but on the other hand, you struggle to sustain that memory. So now I can always reference back to the book. I don't have to remember it.
So you visited Cambodia again after an absence of 20 years. That must have been very emotional as well.
It was. It was extremely difficult. When I landed in Cambodia, I started to realize that I was a guest to Cambodia, rather than I pay a tremendous price for Cambodia, yet that very moment, I felt like I was an outsider. I felt like I was a guest. I'm about to step on the ground where my parents gave their life, or lost their life, or got their life taken away. A place where I lost everything. Later that week or the following week, When I got to my hometown, some people came and visited, and one friend came and told me that he knew where this Khmer Rouge chief, who put my life and my family's life through hell, lived, and he offered that he would kill this guy for a certain amount of money. And I had this guy's life in my hand. And to me, I think that was a defining moment. Because all this time, for 20 years, all I thought about was, okay, I want to go back to Cambodia. I want to find these Khmer Rouge. I want a revenge. I want to kill. I want to torture him. And I never spent so much time thinking about, what do I want to do with myself? What do I want to do with my future? What is it that I want to do? I never thought about that, because so much energy was put into revenging. And then that very moment when I had the opportunity, never thought I would have this opportunity. It's much easier to think about it, but when it comes down to it, it's in your hand, you have a decision, and there's only two decisions. It's either go through with it and kill this guy or walk away. And I chose to walk away. And that was the time where I crossed from the past into the present and ready for the future.
I understand you'll be playing a special role as a Rosarian in the next Rose Festival Parade. Could you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. yeah. This is, it's going to be a profound moment for me. I mean, this is all like a three-way honor to be a part of both Reed College and Royal Rosarians, and also, you know, representing myself and my community. And, you know, it may not be a big deal to a lot of people, but to me, I mean, this is a victory. Everything like this, I declared as a victory on the side of humanity. Think about it. I mean, what the Khmer Rouge regime did was eradicating my faith in humanity. And then things like this happen, which is, you know, you bundle a whole bunch of honors and, you know, all kind of stuff into it. And that, to me, that's a victory on the side of humanity.
Our guest is Ki Long Ung, the author of Golden Leaf, A Khmer Rouge Genocide Survivor. My name is Andrew Ye, and you've been listening to APA Compass. My name is Andrew Ye, and thank you for listening to APA Compass. At Lewis and Clark College in Portland, a group of students, faculty, and staff put together a series of events examining the issues of race and ethnicity. One of the major highlights is a performance piece entitled The Race Monologues, in which students use poetry and prose to express their personal experiences with race, ethnicity, and personal identity. I was lucky enough to see and hear the standing room only performance, and we are lucky enough that two of the performers will share their monologues with us today. We have Goldan Salazar.
My name's Goldan Salazar. I'm a student at Lewis and Clark College.
And Musa Ahmed.
My name is Musa Ahmed, and I was born in Ethiopia, and I moved to Kenya when I was 6 years old. And then from Kenya, I moved to Portland, Oregon, and I've been here in Portland, Oregon ever since. My monologue is in a letter form to a very good friend of mine, named Victor. Dear Victor, it saddens me that race is still a problem of the world. As for you, the white man had no right to ask you where you were from. And even more, he had no right to respond to your answer with, "No, really, where are you from?" And even more than that, he had no right to ask you where your parents were from after you told them for the third time that you were born in California. You are right that you had no problem with exchanging cultures and perspective with the white man, but both of us know that he thinks he doesn't have a culture. He thinks he's simply just an American. I'm glad you find the cutting irony in it all. Remember, Remember at the law school library last year, the white girl who called campus safety on us because her senses told her that three niggers and a Mexican in the library on a Saturday night was too fantastic to be true. Today, we both know the name of those campus safety officers who spoke to us so rudely, asking us what we were doing there, who let us in there, and if we went to school there. And all the while, countless white people were studying all around us. Victor, I don't blame that you transferred from Lewis and Clark College. You asked in your earlier letter what kept me going, what kept my head above the filth of it all. I don't know, but as a man with male answer syndrome, I will attempt to answer. Human progression has not and cannot outlive the usefulness of God. Humans are an ungrateful bunch of reckless sleepwalkers. The beauty of cultures, of earthly resources, suffers and burns at the touch of their cold hands. The vast and infinite darkness of our universe stretches past our satellites and remains undiscovered. Man knows only a heap of images. The thought of the multitude and infiniteness of the cosmos and of its resources makes the business of human beings miniature and copycat in scale. My friend, be glad that man did not make water. Rejoice that he did not make air, because if he did, he would have yet another instrument with which he can torture. Thank God the air is not the business of man. The earth, call her Mother Nature, call her God, but she provides and she takes your life and mine when our echoing existence reaches its time. What are these clumsy racists against the universal master plan? They are crazy and they deserve a laugh. But on a slave ship, when their craziness has forcibly crossed into reality, then, like the unknown man from the Gold Coast, you must silently and quietly, in the thick darkness of the night, on that rocking slave ship, you must slowly and deliberately attempt to cut your throat with your fingernails, and dividing the external jugular, you must continue to tear until death. My brother, abandon the history of humanity and gaze at your fingertips. There is none like yours in this whole planet. Out of this endless universe, God brought you to Earth. Out of a single ejaculation of millions of sperms, he chose you. And out of the billions of life on Earth, he made you an intelligent life, a human life. Even the best gambler in the world couldn't conceive of such odds. In the thousands of worlds seen throughout the galaxy, only the Earth sustains life. Not just any life, but intelligent life. As the Earth turns, we crawl on it, we walk on it, and eventually we will come to sleep within its womb. I say God has suffered too much under the human limitation, and the man of sensibilities weeps at these things. The heart's suffering to find happiness on Earth, it gets too many of us in trouble. If only making our colony, our web, and our honey sufficed. Oh, if only. But man is not into formulas of spiders, bees, and ants. He is a mad prophet, a passionate poet, and a philosophical lover of life. He is the architect of history. With peace and war, your brother.
Thank you, Musa. That was Musa Ahmed sharing his race monologue. We now hear from Goldan Salazar. Goldan's race monologue is a letter she wrote to herself. She also mentions Elizabeth and Christopher, who are her older sister and brother.
Dear Miss Salazar, one day you will forget all of this confusion. Too light to be Mexican, but too foreign to pass. English, too clear to be an outsider, but hair too thick, too dark, and too deep to be from here. Sometimes I don't know. Perhaps I can't conceal the truth with a name like Salazar. Maybe I could just forget. Forget about Papa and Mexico. Forget about Christopher's warm brown skin. I could reinvent myself. Find and marry a man with the last name Smith. Forget Crescencio, Josefa, Maria, Ophelia, and all the others that immigrated here with a desperate hope only to face a crueler discrimination, a different kind of poverty. Yeah, forgetting sounds so tantalizing. Close your eyes and imagine. Imagine the privilege. I can taste its bitter sweetness on my tongue now. 2 years ago, I stood here and shared a story about being at an intersection of being Chicana, a woman, and poor. In my monologue about my father, I told you that after you left for 13 years, I wanted to find you, to see the reflection of me and you, and declare to you, Soy de Mexico. Soy Mexicana. Back then, I only knew a few things about you. I knew when I turned 6, we had only spoken once over the phone, and that you haunted me, especially when they would ask, why is your skin so light, or why don't you speak Spanish, or when they told me you should be ashamed that you've forgotten so much about your culture. I remember waiting for you to come back home, for you to swoop me up in your arms and rub your gruff stubble against my cheek, just to make me squirm and giggle. I remember the smell of your sweet sweat and cologne that would linger in there after you left. But in these 2 years, I have changed my own reality. I wanted to know more and to fill that space that you left with me. I earned the money, bought the round trip ticket. I found you. I got on the airplane. I flew across an imagined border, breaking through all the lines on my way there. I flew to a new world, sat in the airport and waited for our cousins to take us on the 3-hour ride to see you. I didn't expect to see you in the airport. I imagined I would have the whole day to think about what I wanted to say to you. I thought that I could hide from you for a bit longer. But there you were, limping, pacing back and forth in the airport. Elizabeth mumbled, "Gul'dan, wake up. There's a man walking back and forth, and he keeps looking at us. I think it's Papa." You paced towards us again, looking just behind me. You paced by once more. Finally, as you turned, your eyes met mine. I couldn't remember your limber, small frame, your permanent limp from working sun up and sundown at your peanut farm, but I could tell it was you. I could see it in your blank, light grayish brown eyes, the same that I had as a baby. But at that moment, my whole body opened. Every fragmented memory, the fear, the pain, the confusion, the void, each that lived inside of me, asking so many years to be heard, to have room to be felt. And all at once, they sung in sync in me. You walked towards us and asked my sister, "Are you Elizabeth?" She nodded and said, "Yes," and asked, "Do you remember her?" He turned confusingly and looked at me with a blank glaze, looking for someone he recognized. Seconds passed, seconds passed, seconds passed. He shook his head. "No." I sucked in air to mend the sting. I felt my heart fall, fragmented into a million little pieces, each one revealing and unraveling more of what I already knew. My father doesn't know me. But why would he? How could I know anything about him either? How could I expect to repair a split relationship, one divided by the U.S.-Mexican border, by laws, by Minutemen, by hatred, by fear, deserts, farms, brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, fathers and mothers, other people, other human lives? To repair this wound, the deep cut between two merged countries, two countries bound to one another but in conflict, a father and daughter bound to one another but in conflict, Mexico and America connected but misunderstood by each other, a father and daughter connected but misunderstood by each other. Both needed time. Listen, this might sound like a story of disconnect. You all know it, the tale of a tragic mulatta, a lost biracial girl that is constantly switching between her two selves in one world, two conflicting identities. I'm in strife between using nice words to talk about race like diversity and the value of multiculturalism, while nodding at my white allies who think that they do me justice in writing about a common struggle, which is really a demented way of conceptualizing or trying to understand racism, as if they could try to sympathize, as if they could meet me halfway. The other part of me wants to scream out that really you haven't reached a true understanding of the demoralization and the crippling effects racism has on one's humanity, because that would make the past and current realities unbearable. Unbearable for all of us. That would mean that you and you would have to do something about it. You would have to embody the wear and tear that racism takes on each of our souls, warping us from ever recognizing and honoring a shared humanity between me and you, the colonizer and the colonized, the oppressor and the oppressed. But it's not. I say all of this because this isn't my problem. Racism is not about me or really anyone up here. It's about you, about the dominant population. It's not a problem that I created or any of my ancestors created. It's not something I can fix. Racism is your problem, not mine. I love myself and my culture. Find yours. Please stop appropriating ours. Learn to love yourself. We project racism as the problem of the Latino, the Black, the Asian, the Arab, as if we all got together at the People of Color convention and thought it would be a good idea to subordinate ourselves, while whites get to slip into the darkness, into invisibility, go unexamined. This is not my problem anymore. So for all of the struggles, I must be grateful. Thank you, Papa. Thank you, Mama, for making me strong enough to see the raw cruelty of racism. Papa, gracias por la cultura, por mi vida en los Estados Unidos y en Lewis and Clark. Gracias por México y los Estados Unidos. It is ultimately your decision if you want to do something about this or continue exploiting your privilege to continue moving yourself forward. Dear Ms. Salazar, you will redefine what it means to be Chicana American. Don't forget anything. Don't forget La Familia. Don't forget your broken Spanish. Don't forget the unique insight and ability to overcome poverty of the brain and the body. Don't forget La Raza Unida. Most importantly, don't forget that you might never feel quite at home in America or in Mexico, and that's okay.
Gul'dan, what did you expect to gain from this experience, and how did it actually turn out?
By the end, I was actually hoping that people would look at this and use it to evaluate themselves and evaluate their surroundings in terms of racial equity. I think that there's still a lot of racial inequity, not necessarily interpersonal, but definitely institutionally. And I'm just hoping people, I was hoping that people would listen to this and look at how they fit into that sphere, and not look at it to be this problem of us versus them.
And how did it turn out?
I didn't realize I sounded so sad when I was reading it, but it was very, very touching to a lot of people. And so I think that if you can speak to someone's heart in that way, they're open enough to be vulnerable, to think about things that seemed inaccessible before. I think that by me being vulnerable, it allows a lot of people to think about race in a new way and think about sometimes how difficult it can be, and then to turn that back on themselves and think of how they can make the situation better.
Thank you very much to our talented contributors, Gul'dan Salazar and Musa Ahmed. To see photos of Gul'dan or Musa, or to comment on their stories, please visit our website, kbu.fm/APA Compass. My name is Andrew Ye, and thank you for listening to APA Compass.
Thanks for tuning in to APA Compass. I'm Sarika Mehta. Next up, we have an excerpt from an interview I did with comedian Hari Kondabolu. Hari is one of the writers for Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell on FX.
We had the recent Ashton Kutcher Pop Chips debacle, in which Ashton Kutcher appeared in brownface portraying a seemingly pathetic Bollywood director for this ad. And we've also had the NBC sitcom Outsourced. What is your take on South Asians being the latest form of derogatory comic relief in mainstream television and advertising?
I don't know if we're like the latest form. I mean, I think we went from not existing to being a joke, but we've kind of been a joke for a while. I mean, you know, Short Circuit 2, Fisher Stevens was, I thought that dude was Indian. I thought like, oh, there's an Indian actor that made it. This is a white dude, it was Fisher Stevens and brownface. Apu was like an achievement for us, but even though he's like a white dude's voice on The Simpsons, like it was an achievement because there was something. I mean, that's how sad it was. We had something, and it was that. I find it really messed up, and it's kind of an interesting thing because the only justification we have for that character is it's The Simpsons, though, and it's a great show. It's a brilliant show, but that character is what he is, right? It's frustrating because, I mean, all what I think we're fighting for is just the ability to be human in public. That's not asking very much. And I feel like you see that with the black community historically, you know, there's this huge period of minstrelsy, you know, like, you know, white folks in like blackface, and then, you know, black performers allowing, you know, being allowed to perform, but playing really demeaning roles still. And then a slow acceptance of a few figures. And I don't understand why we have to go through all that every time, you know? And the gay community has dealt with that as well. Like, why do we have to go through all those steps? Like, this is obviously a bad idea. And part of it is something my friend Hassan Minhaj said in a response to the Pop Chips thing. We're a clownable minority. Not to justify any kind of racism to any group, but I think there's something about the South Asian community that is seen maybe as docile and weak, and why would they couldn't fight back, and who cares, right? And it's something we have felt growing up. We didn't really have a voice, and we were made fun of both, you know, in school, workplace, and on television and film. Like, we were not seen as part of this. So, I mean, that's what it is. And the accent thing, you know, people have said, well, shouldn't actors have the right to play parts? He was selling chips. Ashton Kutcher was selling chips. This wasn't an interesting part. This didn't have a real point to it. Even if, you know, brownface in any circumstance, I have to seriously consider, but this certainly wasn't it. And Also, in terms of the accent, somebody made a very interesting point on Facebook. A fan had said, like, another thing is that there's so many members of our community who are afraid to speak up for themselves because they hear their accents and are embarrassed and are worried that people will laugh at them. So even when they have something to say, they don't say anything. That's what this is doing. It's furthering that fear of, well, I'm going to be seen as a joke even if I have an interesting thing to say or even if I stand up for myself. So it's very frustrating, and especially in an era when you have Aziz Ansari and Mindy Kaling, and these are mainstream figures. These are powerful figures now, you know, not just actors, but creators of art. It's weird that we still have this as well.
Going back to what you were talking about a little bit earlier, about being a brown man on stage, talking about white privilege to a likely white majority audience, and that's part of the voice you wanted to create anyways. So talk about that experience and your process.
I mean, it's fun when I perform for my audiences, like people that come specifically to see me, because it's not just going to be the mainstream white majority audience. It's like if you, whether in Portland or in Seattle, like it's very racially diverse, people from many different faiths. The queer community is comfortable to come out, which that to me is a big deal because there's so much homophobia at stand-up shows. So that's great that I can be a safe space for people to laugh at. It's like part of me is writing to that audience. And the other part of me also is aware of that's not where I'm going to get most times when, you know, I'm just a comic as opposed to, oh, it's a Hari Kondabolu show versus here's Comic X who's performing in this town or at this college. At that point, I'm anybody, right? They don't know who I am, and I have to find a way to win them over. And it's tricky because there's a bit of a balancing act, right? Like either a joke which is aggressive has to have somewhat of an out as opposed to, you know, when it's my audience where I can say whatever I want, I don't need to worry, I don't need to soften it. Or it's like, okay, I'm going to give you a few hard ones and here's an easy joke about Weezer. You know, like something like that, you know? Well-structured, well-written, and I like the joke, but still like, you know, not necessarily the, for me, coming from the heart. Yeah, I mean, it's tricky and I don't like to compromise. And I think I did a lot of that when I started and I did a lot of that early on because, you know, I think about my set on Jimmy Kimmel Live in 2007, and I look at that set, and I'm horrified by it. I also understand it's like your first time on television. I was working as an immigrant rights organizer. I was asked that week to be on the show. I was scared. You know, I'd never, like, the idea of being on television, I didn't plan a comedy career, you know? Like, I went to school even after all this stuff happened to get a master's in human rights. My background is in organizing and human rights, so it's okay, I think, to make fun of yourself, but I made very deliberate choices to weaken myself so the audience was in it. And I don't want to do that anymore, you know? That's not who I am. So it takes a while, you know, it took a while to get to a place where this is who I am and you're going to accept me for who I am. And if not, then see somebody else.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to APA Compass on KBOO. I'm Sari Gametha, and I'm speaking with comedian Hari Kondabolu.
When I was living in London, I was dating this English woman, and the first 3 months I was there, it was like really exciting. She was over at my place like three nights a week, immediate trust. And then 4 months in, she was over at my place four nights a week, and I noticed she was starting to tell me what to do, like when to wake up and when to sleep and what to eat. And I'm like, this is weird. But like early on in a relationship, you have to set boundaries. So maybe this was part of that boundary setting process. I'm like, okay, let's go with this. 5 months in, she's over at my place five nights a week, and my brother had come to visit. And I don't know what she said to my brother, but by the end of his week there, like, he was angry at me. She had like turned my brother against me. It was so strange. And then 6 months in, I hated how I was being treated. I decided to assert myself, and I said, I don't like how I'm being treated. I'm a human being. I deserve more. And that's when the beating started. And I don't know why she felt comfortable hitting me, but she did, and it was terrible. I felt defenseless. I felt like nobody could help. Nobody was listening. And after 7 months, she's over at my place seven nights a week. She has her own place. She has her own place that she's paying rent for, but she's over at my place every night of the week, eating my food, telling me what to do, hitting me, and that's when I knew this wasn't love. This English woman was trying to colonize me. And I, of course, did what I was trained to do in such situations. Nothing. I simply didn't cooperate. I used nonviolent resistance. And after a month, she finally left. And she took most of my best stuff with her. Food, art,
self-esteem all gone. And she left a few things. She left some clothes and some books and, of course, an extensive railway system. So, for the non-South Asians in the audience, perhaps didn't understand why there was applause, the British built a really extensive railway system throughout India before they left, and it wasn't so much for transportation for the Indian people. It was because it's really hard, of course, to plunder on foot.
Earlier this year, the State Department sent you to India as part of the Make Chai Not War tour.
Yeah.
So talk about that experience, and especially with writing jokes that are based on cultural references and history.
It was very tricky for me to do a show that the State Department sponsored. It's funny because, you know, I've struggled with not wanting to do certain like auditions. And then, you know, I did this tour from the State Department, and the State Department has, to be nice, a mixed record. I should say that it wasn't like the top of the State Department. It was like their cultural affairs division. So the idea was, you know, they usually bring jazz music or things like that from the States to India and try to like say, this is cultural stuff that we're bringing over and sharing. But I think they thought it would be interesting to bring stand-up comics, and because they know there are more South Asian stand-up comics. And my friend Azhar Usman and our other friend Rajiv Satya like started this tour, Make Chai Not War. But yeah, they very graciously asked me to be a part of their tour. And, you know, my issue was I don't want to restrict myself. I want to be the best I can be for that audience, like I always do. I do the best I can for whatever audience is in front of me. You know, it's funny, as much as I talk about not wanting to compromise or restrict myself, performing in India was hard because I didn't know what the groundwork was. I didn't know what was going to be in front of me. I didn't know. And I remember I was talking to my parents about the stuff and really going over what I could say, what I couldn't say. And I never do that, ever. But for this, it felt appropriate. And it was like, well, don't talk about sex. Don't talk about religion. Don't talk about... Basically, by the end of it, it was like, don't talk about anything. It's best you don't talk about... It's best you just stand up there and just wait. And the time will pass. And somebody else will go on stage. It's exaggeration. But, like, you know, they were very worried about everything. I could possibly
say. They
wanted
to protect you.
Yeah, basically. And also their India is an India that in some ways is frozen in the late 70s from their experiences, right? And it's not necessarily big city India either, right? So when I got there, when I was in Chennai, that was the first place, I have this joke that I talk about dating an English woman. My mom likes that joke, and she said, it's a good joke, but change it from like an English woman that you're dating to like a male roommate, because people might be uncomfortable with a woman staying at your place in India, so it's best to just make it, like, take that gender dynamic out of it. And so I did the joke, which made less sense now because of that change, but I did it because, you know, she suggested it. It did fine. It wasn't as great as I'd like, but it did fine. And after the show, these young kids from Chennai, like about my age, like mid-20s, late-20s, and they came up to me, dressed similarly to me. They said they were huge fans, and they were asking me, why didn't you do stuff on Occupy Wall Street? I'm like, I didn't know that would be something you'd want to hear about. And it was a good set, but like we noticed that you seem to kind of hold back a little bit. And I'm like, what do you mean? It's like, well, we've seen your stuff online, and you held back. And that colonialism joke, like you said, it was a man, but it was actually a woman. It was like a woman you were dating. So why did you change it for us? And I said, well, you know, I spoke to my parents, and my mom said that you might be upset, like the audience might be upset if a woman stayed over, so I thought it'd be easier if it was a male roommate. And he just had this look, like he smiled, but he was a little annoyed. And he said, Hari, you know we have sex in India, right? Yeah, I've seen the numbers. It's just a kind of like the shock of it. So like there was me figuring out each city as we went along. And also, it was interesting because we got questions during the Q&A sections of the shows, which we did most shows. And people said...
Next up, an excerpt from Sarika Mehta's interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning author José Antonio Vargas.
Mm-hmm.
You've started a couple of campaigns since publishing your infamous essay in New York Times last year. You've begun a campaign called Define American.
Yeah, I mean, Define American is really about elevating how we talk about immigration in America. You know, like, I think when people hear immigration, the first thing that comes to their mind is, you know, this Mexican brown border ghetto in their heads, right? Like the real on Fox News of people just climbing the wall and just coming to America, when the reality is that's not immigration, you know? That's not the fullness of the immigration issue in America. Like, we barely even hear about the fact that a full million out of the 11 million undocumented people are Asian and Pacific Islander, many of whom are Filipinos, Koreans, Chinese. We never hear that. And so Define American is just broadening that conversation and also making a room for our allies to speak out and stand alongside us. We are not going to fully solve this issue until white people and black people feel comfortable talking about immigration. This is not just about Latinos and about Asian people. I don't consider myself or Define American pushing any piece of legislation. I think we're kind of staying on our lane, which is the cultural lane. You know, before we can actually effectively change legislation and policy, I think we all kind of need to understand what it is we're even talking about. You know, like, I think I can confidently say that immigration is probably the most provocative yet least the least understood issue in America. People just don't know what they're talking about when they talk about immigration. And so for us, it's like really connecting the dots and broadening the conversation and elevating it in such a way. Like here in Portland, I mean, here in Oregon, for example, like there's a new push right now to get the governor to sign an executive order, you know, allowing undocumented people to get driver's licenses, right? Well, why do people want to get driver's license? Like, they don't want to get a driver's license so they can say, oh, you know, screw the law, forget that. They want to get a driver's license because, you know, they want to go to work. They want to drop off the kids to school. They want to go pick up the groceries. We have so lost the human part of this conversation, and that's kind of what we're trying to do.
Talking about this human component of this issue with immigration, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Jonathan Rosa at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst on his Drop the I-Word campaign. I wanted to hear your perspective as a journalist, especially linked to the New York Times, since that is where you published your infamous essay.
About a month ago, I publicly challenged the New York Times and the Associated Press to stop using the word illegal because it's inaccurate, it's dehumanizing, and it's completely, you know, it's imprecise. I mean, for us, I think the biggest argument is it's dehumanizing. It's a slur. And what I find really encouraging, frankly, is how young people are reacting to it. So far, editorials from, like, the Daily Californian to the Michigan Daily, the Yale Daily News, the Cornell Sun, all these college newspapers have decided that they're going to stop using that word because it demeans people. And they understand that this is, you know, that this is an issue that greatly impacts their generation. We're talking about a multicultural America in which when you call somebody illegal, you're actually talking about somebody's mom. You're talking about somebody's sister. So I think kind of bringing that home is really important. And it's been encouraging to see how young people are reacting to it.
Talking a little bit about this and looking back, after you published your essay, or I guess maybe after you wrote it and hit send, how did you feel right at that moment?
I've spent most of my adult life being afraid of it. So it was very, you know, I was very anxious and very, I don't know if scared is the right word. I mean, I just didn't know what was going to happen. But I think once I decided in my head that I was going to do this, there was no going back. You know, I just had to do it. And I don't regret doing it. It's just that for me now, it's like, how can I be as effective as I possibly can be? That's kind of the biggest challenge, really.
Well, how did other immigrants in your similar position react to your bold statement? I imagine there were all kinds of reactions.
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of different reactions. I think there's, you know, it surprises me still every day hearing from people via email or Facebook about them hearing about the story. I'm sure there's also some activists and advocates who've been doing these for years, and all of a sudden it's like this guy just like shows up unannounced. So I'm sure I ruffled some feathers in that regard, but I'm just here trying to do my best. I think all of us kind of have a different, you know, we all play different roles and we all have different strengths and different weaknesses. And I guess I'm just trying to kind of stay on my lane, which is about pushing the media, creating content. I'm working on a documentary. I'm just trying to be as creative as I can be.
this past year and a half, with everything that has happened with your publishing of the essay and then Time Magazine and the passage of the Dream Act, with everything that has happened, what has been most surprising for you?
I'm just surprised at how much people don't know. I've always thought that immigration is such a misunderstood issue, but I guess I underestimated it. I mean, it really is misunderstood. The level of ignorance and the level of just indifference about it has been somewhat shocking to me, especially as I've traveled in places like Alabama and Arizona and Arkansas and Georgia and Kentucky. So that's what surprised me, I think, the most, which is why we have so much work to do.
Thank you so much, Jose Antonio Vargas, for chatting with me on APA Compass.
No, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
You've just been listening to an interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jose Antonio Vargas. You can learn more about his work and keep up with his movement at defineamerican.com. I'm Sarika Mehta, and you're listening to APA Compass on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Last year, the popular South Asian American blog Sepia Mutiny submitted a post that South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley checked off white on her voter registration card back in 2001. Nikki Haley is South Carolina's first South Asian governor and has been at the center of discussions on identity politics. Sepia Mutiny slammed her for checking white on her card, claiming brown pride and disgust with her self-identification. I have to admit, I was also appalled by yet another politician trying to be white to fit in with mainstream America. The thing is, as a person of South Asian descent, the rules for identity are already confused with history and politically charged language. I have spent a decade of my career working for publicly funded agencies. That means that upon hire, I have a particularly rough stack of human resources paperwork to fill out before I can even think about a cup of coffee. And with every new job, I would have to identify myself for demographic data in this paperwork. Sometimes I was given a list of choices where I have to pick one and put a check by it. The choices were usually the following: white, black, Hispanic, Asian, or Pacific Islander. I never felt like I fit into any of those categories, especially if we're talking about my race. I remember in first or second grade on some standardized test, the entire class was told to check white on that form. "Except you, Sarika," the teacher announced. "You fill in Asian Pacific Islander," she informed me as the entire class responded with snickers. So I continued to follow suit when I was given so few choices. On a more progressive HR form, I was given a blank field in which I was supposed to write down my race. "Well, this is interesting," I thought. "Except I still don't know the answer," I told the HR representative. She looked at me and said, "I thought you're Indian." I told her, "I am Indian American, yes, but this is asking for my race. Indian is my ethnicity, not my race. What is my race?" She thought for a moment. "What about Asian?" Uh-oh. The poor HR representative was either on her first day on the job or has never had a question quite like this, because she was a little flustered. She sifted through her own stack of paperwork trying to find the answer and prevent any opportunities for offending the new girl. I kind of felt bad for her because this wasn't really her fault. I told her, "Look, I know they're just trying to racially profile me as part of this background check. I accept that. But if I put Asian, that's not really accurate. What if I write brown? Yikes, it seems calling myself brown makes other people uncomfortable." She shuffled more papers, looked away from me, and started to get up to leave. As she was unable to locate the answer, she told me, "I think it's just best if you write down Indian." Not wanting to cause any more discomfort to other people involved, especially on my first day at a new job, I did what I was told. The exact question came up again during another job, as I was finishing up graduate school. The HR department was less nervous and actually more progressive, but still limited by a government and a language without the correct words. I inquired again because, at this point, guessing my race had become an entertaining icebreaker. "So what is my race? Not my ethnicity, my race. You know, the color of my skin. And I'm just going to tell you right now, I'm fine with saying brown." The HR representative calmly looked through her papers and said, "You're asking the right question, and according to my paperwork, you are descended from Aryans, so you're technically Caucasian." We both looked at each other and actually snorted in our midst of giggles. Then she said, "Yeah, I don't think so." Maybe that's Nikki Haley's ridiculous excuse, but after the discrimination I faced in my life, you cannot tell me that I'm technically Caucasian, especially since my skin is brown, and I'm proud of it. But you know, even that has been up for debate. I remember when I was emerging into those tween years as I entered middle school, one of my cousins adamantly told me that I'm lucky because my skin is fair and I don't even look Indian. That comment made me feel horrible, not to mention confused. What does that even mean? Indian girls aren't beautiful? I'm not brown enough to be Indian, but I'm not white enough to be American? We were only kids, and we already had a clear understanding of the meaning behind the color of our skin and our political borders. I'll admit, my unknown race has helped me out in my international travels, especially during the Bush administration. But it hasn't helped me out in my own country. You know, America. My ambiguous ethnicity is not a get-out-of-jail-free pass. If we are going to spend the time and money collecting demographic data and judging people by it, then at least do it right. My name is Sarika Mehta, and I still don't know what my race is. This is my Angry APA Minute.
Well, folks, here we are at the dawn of a new year, survivors of the not-so-terminal end of the world 2012, and we have a lot to celebrate as Asian Pacific Americans. For one thing, yesterday we saw the swearing-in of U.S. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii's 2nd Congressional District. She's the first American Samoan, the first Hindu House member. Gabbard and her fellow APA Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth are also the first female combat veterans in Congress. 2013 boasts the most diverse Congress ever, with the APA caucus increasing to 11 members, including Hawaii's Mazie Hirono, the first APA female senator, and Mark Takano, the first openly gay person of color to serve in the House. Considering this political progress, not to mention our born-in-Hawaii African-American president who even has an Indonesian-American sister, we can proudly declare that in 2013, here in the United States, racism is over, right? Yeah, right. My name is Kushlani D'Souza, and this is my Angry APA Minute. I came out of a post-holiday haze yesterday to find that, on the worldwide interweb, the political milestones of the 2013 Congress were being overshadowed somewhat by debate over whether a third-party Google Play smartphone app called Make Me Asian is racist or not. To quote one of my favorite bloggers, Angry Asian Man, "Oh, hells no, that's racist." Make Me Asian and the equally offensive Make Me Indian allow users to upload their faces and turn themselves into offensive stereotypes of East Asians and Native Americans. Make Me Asian not only gives users an absurd rice picker hat and Fu Manchu mustache, it even yellows skin tone and slants eyes. These familiar racial tropes harken back to the good old days of political cartoons that supported the Chinese Exclusion Act and bring back the warm, nostalgic glow of World War II internment-era anti-Japanese propaganda cartoons. Make Me Indian, meanwhile, browns the skin. Note that this assumes the user is not brown to begin with, and adds war paint, long hair, and a feathered headband. Is there really a debate about whether these apps are racist? Don't even get me started about the ignorant comments left on the various websites defending these apps as innocent humor. The fact of the matter is, these apps aren't funny or harmless at all. Racist, stereotypical images have been and continue to be used to define marginalized groups as outsiders, as others. They don't innocently point out ethnic difference. Rather, these stereotypes distort and demonize difference. It's important to remember that racism does not depend on intent. Are fans and defenders of this app necessarily being intentionally racist? Irrelevant. Racist images like the ones provided by these apps benefit groups in power, in this case, white folks, by reminding us all who is and who isn't normal, who is and who isn't American. Stereotypical images like Fu Manchu and Chief Wahoo are used to reinforce white power in the United States, the same way that stereotypes about African American ethnicity and culture are used. Just like blackface, make me Asian and make me Indian are examples of how cultural appropriation often accompanies privilege. When you're in the privileged group, you have the power to try on different ethnicities without having to deal with the day-to-day realities of being a minority. This kind of cultural appropriation is part of a long tradition of denying discrimination by masking it as appreciating or acknowledging, or in this case, joking about difference. So, which image is more important? The yellow and brown face racism of make me Asian and make me Indian? Or the beaming and hopeful faces of those newly sworn in APA representatives and senators? That question is impossible to answer. The latter image gives me hope that we're making strides toward racial equality in the United States. And the former reminds me that we have a long way to go. My name is Kushlani D'Souza, and this has been my Angry APA Minute. Thanks for listening to APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. APA Compass airs at 9 a.m. the first Friday of each month right here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland. The show is collectively produced by Sarika Mehta, Andrew Yeh, and Kushlani D'Souza, with help from Liz Rogers, Marie Lowe, Tony Tabora-Roberts, Patty Sakurai, Tuvan Huang, and Brian Yarn. You can listen to our podcasts at www.kboo.fm/APA Compass and like our Facebook page, APA Compass Radio.
KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, January 4th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. First up, Northwest anarchists are under attack once again. Where are they? Is the target this time as someone with nothing to do with anarchism? Sleep, as a part of Occupy Eugene, is taking to the streets once again to demand the right of everyone everywhere to have a safe place to sleep. Isn't this the least that we can do? And Shahid Buttar with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee is back today to continue the conversation begun on Monday around things that can happen to your rights while you're sleeping. First, the weather. Mostly sunny for today, high near 46, and light east-northeast winds tonight. Bit of patchy fog later on, otherwise increasing clouds, lows around 35 for tomorrow. 50-50 chance of rain, highs near 45, and tomorrow night, rain with a low around 37. Sunday, 50-50 chance once again. Cloud. I wonder how that changes the odds if you've got 50-50 both days. Actually, they're separate statistical incidents. Anyway, we've got a high of 44, and then Sunday night, full circle, a chance of showers, mostly cloudy, lows around 39, bringing us to Monday morning and the alternative forecast. This is a last quarter root moon in Virgo. It's 22 days old. The synodic forecast, not a good time to sow anything in the garden, I'll say, and how. Instead, use this time to weed and harvest if there's anything that hasn't blown